Okay, any preliminary housekeeping kinds of issues? I did take the book to Kinko's, and they said it would be ready on Friday. Somebody reminded me in the last class that we don't have class on Monday, which is when I was thinking of handing them out. So I'll hand them out on Tuesday. If you need a book sooner than Tuesday, I'll email you to let you know the books are available. I expect to have them sometime on Friday. But if Tuesday's soon enough for you, just come to class on Tuesday with $10, and I'll give you a book for $10. Yes, Ms. Stomper. By Tuesday, I'm guessing, let's see, in the last class we got as far as through the Hammond tree case, so where would that put us here? By Tuesday, I'm expecting that we would be somewhere, I don't know. I'm in the morning section, the 11 o'clock section, so I'm guessing that's where we'll, as far as we'll get today. And so I would say we'll be through, you know, roughly page 12 maybe, or 14 or something, I don't know. Well short of page 30 or 34, which you already have. So if the only reason I would be anxious to get a book sooner is if for some reason you've got to read ahead and need the book sooner than that. That is, read ahead of Tuesday's class and so on. Any other housekeeping logistical questions? I actually had some attendance sheets, but I don't know what I did with them. So, is anybody missing an attendance sheet? Okay. All right, so as far as I'm concerned, we're just starting Chapter 1, and again, I gave you kind of an overview on yesterday. So what we need to do is look at Mrs. Bierman and what happened to her and figure out what we can learn about the relationship of these various concepts to the idea of liability. So, is that the way you say it? Can you tell me about Mrs. Bierman? Okay, before we get there, so far so good, let's just pause for a moment. And so she files her claim, it finally gets, the day of trial arrives. She goes to small claims court expecting to find Judge Judy or Judge Wapner or whatever, but apparently there's some hitch in the giddy-up here. What's the problem? Yeah, there weren't enough judges to go around. So then what did they do? What the heck is that? Yeah, it's actually a big claims court with a judge in it who's used to doing big claims cases, but they say, hey, for today, put on your small claims court judge hat and pretend you're Judge Watner or Judge Judy and be a small claims court judge. Okay? So once they get there, Mrs. Bierman's, you know, walking around her soggy tennis shoes and telling the judge about this broken water main, what's the defendant's response? The city, and I sort of interrupted you. You were starting to say this. But just kind of let's pick the story back up of substantively, what's their argument here? Yeah, so as we're sort of imagining this, Mrs. Bierman describes essentially what happened, and the defendants say, yeah, but we never heard the word negligence used, or at least she never provided us with any, provided you, Judge, with any evidence that we were negligent. And, says the defendant, the significance of that fact is... Yes, they say that the law that Judge Younger ought to apply is that unless she can prove they were negligent, she doesn't recover. Now, Mrs. Bierman, I don't know nothing about no stinking Foldis case here. She's not up to speed on that, but Judge Younger, as it turns out, is ready to sort of intercede on her behalf. And what's Judge Younger's response to the claim by the defendants that he's bound by this Foltis case?
Well, he says he's got the idea.
Well, it's not just his own idea. I, Judge Younger, think such and so. He, in turn, acts as though he's operating under authority. Whose authority? Whose authority is he relying on to do what it is he's about to do? Well, before he gets to that one, Ms. How do you say your last name?
Amadapur.
Yeah, he says, the legislature's given me my marching orders. As a small claims court judge, I'm supposed to what? What is it I'm supposed to do? Yeah, but by what criterion? By the Foltis case or other kinds of precedent? In light of, you used the word earlier, I'm just kind of reminding of what you said, he thought he was supposed to do. Right. Do substantial justice, and his understanding is that when he put on his small claims court hat, he was doing something different from what he would have been doing if he had been in big claims court, and this was Citibank filing a $3 million water damage case against the city of New York. He thinks the rules are different because he's acting in his capacity as a small claims court judge. Now, that very issue becomes controversial, and not everybody agrees with him on that point, but just so we're following what he's doing, he says, I'm supposed to be a little more open-minded here about what the rules are. That, having been his interpretation of what it is he's supposed to be doing, he now gets up in the saddle here and starts riding off in search of substantial justice. And where does he go looking for that? Where does he go looking for the criteria for what in this case would be substantial justice? Right. He finds some law review article written, as it turns out, by this guy Calabresi, who, as it happens, was my torts professor. Later became the dean of the law school, eventually became a Second Circuit court judge, and has a fairly substantial reputation in this whole world of legal scholarship. So it's a fairly You know, if you're going to go looking, this is as good a place to go looking for scholarship as any. However, the question remains, what's he doing, in effect, making this stuff up? But apparently that's what he thinks he ought to do. And what does Calabresi say is the nature of this tort system, and by what criteria do we judge the rules of substantial justice? Okay, let's take these one at a time here. Tell me about this cost spreading concept. What does that mean? Let me just pause here for a second. I'm not sure he's quite ready to, in terms of describing cost spreading, we're not yet to the point of actually looking at this particular case. What we're trying to do is get a bead on when Calabresi makes the claim in his article that one of the functions of the tort system is to accomplish cost spreading. What's good about cost spreading? What's the idea there? Why is that a good thing? Why is it better that all of us pay a little bit rather than that you pay a whole lot? Well, I mean, if your bicycle gets stolen, is it more fair that you have to go out and buy a new bicycle or that all of us chip in $2 to pay for a new bicycle? All the people who consume water in the city of New York are going to pay a very, very, very tiny, you know, percentage more, so the business beerman doesn't have to walk around in soggy tennis shoes and replace her own knickknacks. She's going to get other people to pay for this. Why is that a good thing? Why is it fair? Well, fair, actually, we get to elsewhere, but just so we understand, why, as a general proposition, this idea of cost spreading is desirable, attractive? Where do we find this phenomenon, not just in the tort system, but elsewhere in your life you've encountered the phenomenon of cost spreading? What's that? Yeah. Yeah, you're about to see this little downward sloping demand curve, or the downward sloping value of money. That is, the theory is that each dollar you earn is worth less to you than the last dollar you earned. The first dollar puts a roof over your head, clothes on your back, food on your table. The last dollar you earn gets you high-speed internet access and a first-class upgrade when you fly to Tucson. But that's worth less to you than having food on your table or clothes on your back. So the idea is, and this is essentially the idea of insurance, why would all of us put in $2 to pay, you know, for a new bicycle? You might not be able to afford a bicycle. The rest of us say $2, I'll have to forego my latte for today, but that's better than not having a way to get to and from school. So we often pay for insurance out of sort of the last dollars we earn, so that if your house burns down or you're in the hospital and need an operation or have some other kind of desperate need for money, you're going to get it. Now, the tort system accomplishes this to the extent that plaintiffs who suffer injuries, Mrs. Bierman's is not as catastrophic as some might be, but the people in the bicycle shop in the next case, or you know, the kid who gets electrocuted when the wire he's fiddling with hits the electric line. When you suffer an injury like that, having other people compensate may add to the cost of a trolley ride, or it may add to the cost of auto insurance, but that's a small over here amount relative to this big catastrophic injury. That's the theory. Now, one of the things we haven't quite figured out is how all this theory fits in with reality, or what happens when these different principles conflict. But Calabresi, at least, is arguing that one of the things we like about the tort system is that it accomplishes this cost-spreading function. It operates sort of like an insurance program. Okay? The next thing that Calabresi claims is the purpose of this, or one of the things the tort system is supposed to do. Okay? And tell me about that. Well, let's think more broadly again about what is it we hope that the tort system is going to do as far as injury prevention. What's our expectation? That because we have certain kinds of tort rules that make you pay in some circumstances and don't make you pay in others, how does that relate to injury prevention? Not necessarily all possible precautions, but it's going to encourage them to take socially useful kinds of preventive measures. For example, the city of New York is not going to take all possible measures to prevent their water mains from breaking, but we hope that one of the functions of the tort rule we adopt, whether it's a rule of strict liability or a rule of negligence, the result of that rule will be to encourage people like the city of New York or Con Ed or whoever else to adopt those safety measures that are socially beneficial, reducing accidents to their optimum level. Now, a guy like Calabresi is actually, he has a training in economics and uses all the economics lingo to suggest that there are some accidents that are worth having because they're too expensive to avoid. Most of us drive cars that are less than the absolute safest car on the road. And the reason is to purchase that extra unit of safety, to upgrade to that, you know, latest, safest car, costs us too much. Either literally we can't pay that, or we'd have to forego some feature of the car, you know, whether it's a convertible or an SUV or something else, that would come at too high a price. We'd rather take the chance. So in that sense, there are accidents worth having because they to avoid them is too expensive relative to what we're willing to pay. Now, one of the things, this whole idea about viewing the tort system as an economic system in terms of efficiency, the whole Chicago School of Economics, Richard Posner and Richard Epstein and Frank Easterbrook and the whole Chicago crowd that claim they can explain things in economics terms, whether that is a satisfying view of the system or not, I will leave to another day. But at least, again, part of Calabresi's claim here is that as we evaluate tort rules, we ought to look to see, well, what impact would this rule or that rule have on the level of injury prevention? Are we getting closer to or farther away from this optimum balance between spending money for more safety versus taking chances and having a certain number of accidents? Okay. What's the final criterion here? What's that all about? Okay. Not yet. I just want to make sure we understand how these things relate to one another. I mean, in one sense, you would think you could skip one and two, that the nature of the system, the criterion by which we judge a legal rule ought to be, is it fair? And in a sense, you could say, along with Immanuel Kant, fiat justius et periat mundus, do justice and let the world disappear. But for most people, fairness doesn't by itself generate an obvious outcome. I don't know whether it's fair to make the city of New York pay or fair to make Mrs. Bierman put up with her soggy tennis shoes and damaged knickknacks. And so we might look at other criteria. I don't know whether it's fair to make people who make snow tubes pay for injuries when people push kids out of the way so they won't get hurt and then suffer spinal cord injuries. Maybe that's fair, maybe it's not. I don't really know. So to the extent that we have sort of indeterminate fairness considerations, it may then lead us to say, well, what about the impact on injury prevention, and or does this, while we're at it, accomplish some cost spreading, which we like? Now let's take the question of how Younger applies these criteria to this case. What's his verdict on these criteria? Even if they weren't negligent. Okay, so Younger, just starting at the bottom here on the fairness consideration, we haven't talked about the other two yet, but with respect to fairness, Younger says, as far as Mrs. Bierman's concerned, she's sitting in her basement minding her own business, suddenly it's full of water, the city's water. And yeah, they blame Con Ed, and we're not exactly sure what's going on there, but the point is, as between these people, it seems like if it's their water, they ought to pay for it. Seems fair to him. Now, again, that's a somewhat subjective question, you know, what's fair, what's not. Some cases sort of cry out in terms of, here's a person who's speeding and drunk and runs over a little kid on a bicycle who's minding his own business. Well, yeah, to say that the defendant has to pay for that injury, well, yeah, that would be fair. Not to make the defendant pay would be unfair. There may be other cases where fairness cries out in the other direction. You have some burglar who falls through a skylight and wants the school district to pay for the injuries because he wasn't warned about the, you know, limitations of, the weight limitation on the skylight. Well, wait a minute, what would be fair about that? Why should the taxpayers pay for some burglar burglar safety? But in between, in the cases of a guy who gets hurt because a snow tube's coming down the hill, and the fairness consideration, as I say, is a little more iffy. Now, let's go back to these other two. What about cost spreading vis-a-vis Mrs. Bierman and the City of New York? What does Younger think about that? Well, to the extent, again, all of the people who use the water, if along with using the water went this sort of little built-in insurance policy that if the water main ruptures and it causes damage, you get to a certain level of compensation for the damage that's caused, that seems like a reasonable trade. I don't mind paying 0.00001 cents more per million, whatever it is, per cubic feet of water if I get this benefit in return. Similarly, when you fly on an airplane, part of the cost of your ticket is the cost to buy a sort of insurance policy, because when airplanes crash, typically the airline pays the victims of the plane crash some measure of damages. Now, you might ask the question, do I want a variable insurance benefit, or do I want a fixed insurance? Would it be better or worse if in buying this ticket I got a certain level of coverage that says if the plane crashes, I get 200 and I get killed, my heirs get $250,000, or would it be preferable to say the amount of compensation depends on who I am and what kind of damage is caused by my death? Am I, some promising athlete who's worth millions of dollars, or am I some retired guy who's not worth much in terms of economic harm? Should the amount vary depending upon who it is, or should it be a flat rate? Again, that's something we look at in Chapter 3 when we start taking up the issue of damages. But we're already doing a little bit of this cost spreading, in effect, when we participate in these systems that have a measure of tort compensation. But he says here, cost spreading favors allowing her to recover and not requiring her to prove negligence. What about injury prevention? How would the adoption of a rule of strict liability help or hinder the goal of injury prevention? Right. Now, notice it's not a huge difference if, according to the rule of the Foltis case, they would only be held liable if you could prove they were negligent. They would still take those precautions that a reasonable person would be expected to take. But if you impose a rule of strict liability, they may figure there are some cases we're not going to win, and maybe it's worth it in those cases to try to avoid injuries to the extent we can. It's a pretty marginal difference, but such as it is, it would encourage them to inspect their system or figure out ways to avoid broken water mains that are going to cause flooding damage. Mr. Cafferty? Not negligent, because each individual circumstance, each time a water main breaks, if you follow the Foltis rule, which says you've got to prove negligence, it would require you to establish, well, what did the city do in this particular case that was negligent? Did they fail to inspect it on a regular basis? Did they repair it improperly? Did they wait too long to replace water mains that over a certain period of time deteriorate? And again, part of, I think, Judge Younger's reasoning in this case is for $300, no one can afford to evaluate what anybody did in this case. I'm not going to send some... If it were a $3 million case, I might be able to send a remote probe, a fiber optic connected camera running down the line, checking it out for all sorts of what was going on there. I could do some seismic things and evaluate the structure of this particular thing and so forth. I could do a really sophisticated analysis to figure out whether they used reasonable care. But for $300, I can't afford to do that. I'd have to speculate and guess about it. But again, it wouldn't necessarily mean not every time a water main breaks were they negligent. Each new case would require us to look at that again. Now, one of the things Younger says, in effect, is why bother with that? Why not just impose a rule of strict liability, at least in this case? Mr. Johnson? And part of what we have to do later on in this chapter, particularly as we start the second half of the chapter on strict liability, is ask the question, what differentiates these cases from those cases where we require the plaintiff to prove negligence. What's the bright line here? What's the dividing principle that separates the sheep from the goats? And it's not easy right off the bat to articulate what that dividing line is, what criterion we're going to use. Mr. Viviano? Well, when we've gone through Chapter 1, you'll look back at the Bierman case and say, gee, you could have used this theory, you could have used that theory. It's actually, there's a lot of sort of unutilized tools that could have been, if Mrs. Bierman had been represented by a lawyer, if this had been a $3 million case, she could have developed a fairly sophisticated legal theory to go along with it. And part of what's entertaining about the case is that you have, in effect, this little vignette of life in which you say, well, what would we do if we were kind of making up the tort rules from scratch, which Judge Younger does. Again, the question is, did he do right in this or did he do wrong? Now, again, one of the questions that you have to ask in this case is, what is the difference? We've already sort of answered this, but what's the difference between his thinking process in small claims court versus the way he would have handled this in big claims court? What's the difference? In what? Well, maybe, arguably he does. That's his whole appeal to the legislature. He gets slapped down later on by his bosses. The Court of Appeals says, go back to sleep, Judge. You're getting too frisky here. But before we got to that, he at least had a claim that the legislature authorized him to view this case differently compared to the way he would be required to view it if he put his big claims court hat back on, and this were the Citibank wanting $3 million for damaged computer equipment. Why? Well, we have the legislature's supposed instruction on this. Why would they even give a different instruction? Why don't they simply say, why is it that they authorized the judge to do substantial justice? Why don't we do substantial justice all the time? So why is that out of bounds when we're in big claims court? Why when things really matter and we really need for there to be justice, we suddenly apparently throw justice out the window and follow some, you know, precedential, we sort of forget we're human beings or something. What's that all about? Are we better off or worse off as a result?
I would say worse off, but that's my opinion.
That's until you graduate. Then when you graduate, see, suddenly the world needs lawyers and is better off because we're here to make everything complicated. Is that all that it's all about? That it's simply the advantage of making work for us, that we get to manipulate all these rules and precedents and fussy little things, that we can't just sort of do substantial justice? There are, but should there be? Why? But are we getting closer or further away from justice when we start insisting on this conformity to precedent and the rules of evidence and procedure and all that kind of stuff? Is that getting closer to justice or getting further away? Consistency, that there is a sense of justice which is predictability and consistency, which at some point overtakes your sense of what might have been my choice if I were drawing on a blank slate. That is, if you treated this person this way, and now it's my turn, and I sort of looked at what happened before, and I kind of ordered my life thinking that that was what the rule was, if you come to me and suddenly you say, oh, now we've decided the way we treated that person was unfair and now we're going to change the rule and treat you differently, you would have a sense of being, not just that it happened to work against you, but the sense of saying, wait a minute, one of the things I want in a legal system is predictability and consistency, even if, you know, again, to use the sports analogy, okay, if the referees are going to call a tight game in basketball where they, you know, call a foul at the slightest contact, so long as they do it at both ends of the court, we can live with that. Or if it's a, you know, melee out there, it's worldwide wrestling or whatever it is that's going on, well, we can live with that too, just so long as it's consistent. But you shouldn't change the rules in the middle of the game. So people like Citibank and the city of New York are less interested in, maybe us little folks would be more interested in it, but the big players at least are interested in having a series or a system of consistent, predictable rules. And to some extent, we do have a little bit of tension here between the interests of the people, as you say. There's actually a very, very provocative law review article that I read when I was in law school. It is still a very widely read. It's called, I think, Why the Haves Come Out Ahead, written by a guy named Mark Galanter at the University of Wisconsin. It was basically he described one-shot players and repeat players. And one of the realities in the system is you have repeat players who come back again and again to play the system, and they obviously have different interests and different skills relative to the one-shot player whose car gets wrecked and wants to go down and get compensated for this car wreck but doesn't have the resources to educate themselves about the system, and even going out and finding a lawyer and, you know, so forth, that's a big hassle. And should the system be set up more for the repeat players or more for the one-shot players, or how do you balance these sort of competing visions of what the legal system is supposed to be? Now, again, Judge Younger is sort of being on Mrs. Bierman's side here and less interested in the arguments for consistency and predictability. And he gets, in effect, slapped down for it later on. The Court of Appeals says you have some flexibility in terms of the rules of procedure and the rules of evidence, but as far as the substantive rules, you should track the precedential substantive law such as you're able to determine it. The writ that you have as a small claims court judge does not run to the extent of essentially making up new rules of substantive law. It's Mr. Hall. I don't know, but let's talk about just the very phenomenon. It cost a lot of money just for these lawyers to show up in court. I mean, even back in 69, when this case was decided, billing rates were not what they are today, but just what they would have charged, what these lawyers would have charged their clients to show up for this hearing in small claims court would have been more than $300. I mean, even assuming they knew they were going to win, why did they bother to show up rather than simply calling up Mrs. Bierman and say, you know, can we settle this thing? What's going on here? Why? Moreover, when they lose, they spend a lot of money getting the Court of Appeals to overturn it. What's going on? Now, but remember, small claims court is dispensing justice, but it doesn't even produce an opinion. I mean, that's another weird thing about this case. When was the last time you read an opinion from a judge in a small claims court case citing, you know, legal scholarship? Not likely. So that by itself is weird. But again, what's going on that these guys, they didn't know they were going to run into Judge Younger. What was going on in the minds of the city of New York and Con Ed that they showed up for this thing in the first place? There's no precedential value. But that they care, or to show you can't push me around, you can't fight City Hall. There's not a precedent in a legal sense that the rule of strict liability would be established by this case, but there would be a precedent that if you complain about something, City Hall will send you a check. I don't want that word getting out on the street. I'd much rather have the word get out on the street. Oh, you can't fight City Hall. Good luck, you know. Even if you win, they'll appeal it and they'll do all these other things to you. Now, you know, at some point, both defendants and plaintiffs have to figure out what sort of balance are you going to strike between this millions for defense, not one penny for tribute, versus, hey, you know, for a couple of bucks here, we could get out of this thing, compared to spending a whole boatload of money on a fruitless scorched earth policy. Mr. McElvenna? So your shoes are not only soggy, but I follow you here. Okay. Well, so again, the city is trying to convince people, you don't want to mess with us. Don't mess with Texas. Don't mess with the city of New York. And it makes a certain amount of sense, although there does seem to be a little bit of animus here. By the way, what's your guess as to what Judge Younger did before he became a judge? Worse. No. Law professor. And actually, if you take trial practice, you may very well watch. There's an old set of wonderful set of tapes, just Irving Younger on cross-examination. He was a brilliant trial lawyer and very funny to boot, but obviously full of interesting ideas and frisky and the kind of guy who would write an opinion in a small claims court case. Now I begin to see this, you know, this picture begins to come together here a little bit. But, you can see the way the lawyers didn't like what Judge Younger was doing here and wanted to teach him a lesson, just as he was sort of trying to teach them a lesson. And they, you know, the world of law is made up of personalities, and sometimes personalities play a bigger role than purely strategic, precedential kinds of things. It gets personal at some level, not necessarily in a bad way. Thanks to this little personality conflict, we have this interesting case. I'm quite grateful to them for giving us this. But again, you know, sometimes in your career, things don't go according to what you think they will. Let me just change gears here to talk briefly about Hammond Tree, because the two cases kind of fit together here in terms of the overall issue about how you formulate legal rules. So let's, Mr. Liebman, can you tell us about Hammond Tree? Okay. Now, if we did this case solely on the basis of a negligence standard, that is, if you had to prove that the defendant was negligent, it's not a very strong case. I mean, you could say he was negligent for driving at all, but on the other hand, apparently his doctor, the state of California, thought he was safe to drive. And the seizure is through no, you know, it's a force beyond his control, and that's what caused the accident. Now, what is the plaintiff's strategy in this case? What's the plaintiff's legal strategy? They don't want to have to prove negligence. What do they want to do? How are they going to win compensation, or so they think? Mr. De La Rosa? They want the court to impose absolute liability. In this way, you see how it's like the Bierman case, that just as in that case, the plaintiff says, I don't want to have to prove negligence. So in this case, the plaintiff wants the court to impose this rule of strict liability. On what authority does the plaintiff claim the judge could give this to the jury on the basis of a rule of strict liability? I mean, obviously we had the problem with Judge Younger in the previous case, but what's the plaintiff's argument here? How can you get there from here? By what authority? Mr. Sullivan. And Mr. Liebman, how does that analogy work here? Right. Okay, but isn't the plaintiff saying in just the same way that a manufacturer can be held liable even though they're not negligent, but if the product they sell turns out to be defective, they have to pay for the injuries that it causes? Why isn't it fair to say, at the risk of sounding insensitive, to say, hey, this guy with a seizure disorder, if his seizure disorder kicks in and his driving is now defective, why don't we make him liable for the injuries caused by that condition? But remember, the rule of strict liability doesn't look to whether you're acting reasonably or not. We're not saying you should have done better. You, We're just saying, hey, look, you sell products, you benefit from it, you take the risk. Mr. Jenner, you drive this car, you take the benefits, but you also should be prepared to belly that you impose. What's wrong with that argument, says the court? Why won't the court buy that argument? Okay, and they're not even sure they're ready to even get to the merits yet. They say the resolution of that question on the merits belongs where? You pass the buck. And again, one of the things we're going to watch as we go through this court case is that sometimes the courts say, well, yeah, we used to follow this rule, but that rule stinks. Here's our new rule. And sometimes the courts say, well, yeah, you've made this argument that that old rule stinks, but you know what? The place to make that argument is down the street in the legislature. We're just a court. We can't do stuff like that. And one of the issues, again, is, well, when is it that you should say one thing and when should you say the other? When do you want courts to abide by these old rules, follow the predictability and precedential value, and when do you say, but wait a minute, these are, you know, the times call for a different attitude. We don't want to continue this bad old system. So again, it's one of the things we'll just be monitoring as we go along, and we'll pick up with that on Tuesday.